Scotty J by the time he caused a stack-up of cars on the Sunset Highway as we were driving to Seaside. You know, to score some chicks. The sun was in his eyes, so he just slammed the brakes on. Fantastic. It's 503-733-2970.
Was that back in the days when he was modeling underwear?
Yes. You don't even want to... Oh, here's another story. Oh, wait, I got to save this one. Somebody sent me some other exciting stories about Scotty J.
Ooh.
Ladies...
Scotty, be careful who you trust.
Seriously. No comment. Okay,
thank you. Did you send pictures?
No. No, this is from a woman. This is from, I think... Let me check. This is from a woman. Subject line, Scotty J is like no other person on the planet. Let me share a few stories. And then she proceeds to do so. Thank you. We'll get to those later. Ladies and gentlemen, make way for the official prophet, president, seer, and revelator of the Rick Emerson Show, Tim Riley.
It's time for the Rick Emerson Noon News Hour from AM 970 Solid State Radio. And now, from the Ministry of Truth, this is Tim Riley.
Disastrous bone-chilling winds, trees blowing down, power out all over the place. So there are three versions of the story. One says, more than a million people without power. Then there's one that says, 250,000 without power, or 100,000 without power. So take your choice. But apparently there are a lot of people without power throughout Oregon and Washington State. A Route 520 bridge over Lake Washington, Seattle, suffering significant damage. There are lots of power lines and trees down all over the place, and these two people in Oregon recount their nightmarish experience.
All I heard was like a snap.
We were just so fortunate that we came out alive.
And these people are where?
They're in the suburbs of somewhere.
A tree snapped and landed in their house. Whatever shall they do? See, I don't think I even lost power. No, that's not true. I guess I did lose power at one point early on because I can always tell when I go home because it's opened up a bunch of windows on your computer where it's like, would you like to update software now? And if that only happens when you reboot. So I guess must have happened. But, you know, I took Sarah home after the show yesterday, and so I would have been home by like 4. And
in the morning?
No, in the afternoon.
Oh.
Because right after the show, because Sarah didn't feel like, you know, waiting. She was sick. She didn't want to wait for the bus. And I had to go home to feed the dog anyway, blah, blah, blah. So I duck home for lunch, drop Sarah off, go to my house, and I leave about half an hour later, and then I know it didn't go off again. So and maybe the Lord, usually he smiles on the suburbs. So maybe his aim was off last night, and he smiled on the...
It wasn't even a Walgreens open.
Southeast. Either way, we were afraid that the show was going to get canceled, that the L.A. Guns concert was going to get canceled last night, and it went off without a hitch, though. So
apparently there's some problems at Portland International Airport this morning. Some 30 flights were canceled, but apparently things are back to normal now. And, of course, those crazy people from Texas on Mount Hood, that trio of hikers. It says here, the National Guard commander, who's trying to assist in the rescue, said they did all the right things. Now, how is that possible if they're still lost?
It seems like
they did all the right things.
It really does seem like it's a binary.
Now, most people read that with a straight face and not even comment on it. But really, seriously,
really logically speaking, mm-hmm. How could you have done all the right things and yet still be a cube up in a cave somewhere? It doesn't really seem like the math is off somewhere in that equation.
Well, Captain Chris Bernard of the 304th Rescue Squadron says Kelly James, Brian Hall, and Nico Cook signed in at the Hood River Ranger Station, leaving an important clue as to the equipment they were carrying.
We have food, fuel, ropes, shovel, bivy sacks, heavy parkas, etc. We have experience on Rainier, Denali, South American Expedition, etc.
Still, okay. It wasn't enough.
And the word is spelled et cetera, by the way. E-T-C-E-T-E-R-A. I know that it makes me sound like an a-hole when I start talking about this, but
he's the captain. Then we have the commander-in-chief.
I'm sorry. He did everything right. You know, the thing is, and I'll guarantee you this, I didn't watch any local news coverage last night, because really, why would you?
I couldn't. My laptop lasted about an hour and a half on the battery. Then it was Betty Bye time.
But you know that they did the, authorities say that the three hikers did everything correctly. Now sports. And they're just shuffling their paper and then smiling their big dopey smiles.
They shake their heads.
Really? So and then they look and then they turn to each other. A sad story. Yeah, you know, our prayers are with them. Well, a high school softball team. And then they go right into the next thing. But, you know, but clearly they didn't do everything right.
So they did a lot of things wrong.
That should be our new slant on this. What did the hikers do wrong? Why does God hate hikers?
Captain Bernard says rescue personnel haven't pulled off Mount Hood because of the worsening weather.
The rescuers tell me we've done what we can. We've searched what we need to search. I want to reiterate, though, the rescue mission continues.
Uh-huh.
Yet they did all the right things.
We wish you well in your future endeavors.
Yes. At long last, it is the last day for Donald Rumsfeld. He's being ushered out of the Pentagon with full honors. The president leading a formal Pentagon farewell ceremony for Rumsfeld, who has vacated the office he has inhabited since Bush took office.
You're fired, today is your last day, you're fired.
As his tenure at the Pentagon draws to a close.
I'm just trying to imagine what.
That was well done. What more needs to be?
Timed up perfectly.
Spur of the moment,
you did all the right things.
It's genius. I mean, it's just funny, and especially that.
Play it again and try something different.
That thing, that thing from Cheney, that he's the best Secretary of Defense we've ever had. As literally,
you're
like,
doing a good job, Rumsfeld.
You're doing a heck of a job, Rummy. As they're sealing his things into boxes and having them, you know, shipped into deep storage.
Rumsfeld says his greatest regret is that the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan haven't been concluded as rapidly as he'd like.
We can't lose a single military battle in either country at all. Not possible. But we can't win without help from others.
Did he really just say that?
We can't lose a single military battle in either country at all. Not possible. But we can't win without help from others.
I'm lying. I'm gonna go home and drink now, 'cause I'm fired.
You know, if these people would line up and fight like American soldiers, we wouldn't be having all these problems.
What we'd like the Iraqis to now do is to dress in bright red clothing and march in a single formation line.
Correct.
Towards our guns. And then this will all be resolved in time for
just as the Nazis did, because this is just like World War II.
Exactly.
As we've been told.
Only longer and less successful.
Well, the White House is continuing to avoid public speculation about ailing Senator Tim Johnson. We all know about his brain problems. Tony Snow said the White House continues to hope and pray for his recovery.
Dick Cheney would cast the tying vote, and the Republicans would be able to organize the Senate, and the Democrats would lose their majority.
Oh, yeah, but Lisa Goddard, though, she gave the definitive word that can't happen, that he would have to quit. Or be impeached, I think. That's the other thing she said, or whatever it is. It's just really just being in a coma. I mean, I don't mean to make light of this, but really, how great is that? How emblematic is that of the entire American political process? That just being in a completely incapacitated, vegetative state is not enough to keep you from being a senator. Really, there's like a year's worth of Jay Leno jokes and Mark Russell PBS specials in that.
President Bush says he is happy for Mary Cheney, the openly gay daughter of Vice President Cheney. So revealed earlier this month, she is pregnant. I think Mary is going to be a loving soul to her child, the president said in an interview with People magazine, and I'm happy for her. Bush was asked about Mary Cheney's pregnancy in light of his previous statements that a child, ideally, should be raised by a family headed by a married father and mother. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said that Bush has not changed his mind. But he also believes that every human life is sacred and that every child who comes into this world deserves love. And he believes that Mary Cheney's child will, in fact, have loving parents.
Despite her heathenistic San Francisco values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Asked if Bush believes that children who are raised by gay and lesbian parents are at a disadvantage, Snow said, he does not make comment on that. Nor will I.
He does not appreciate the corner that he's been painted into by the vice president's daughter.
Mary Cheney is 37, and her partner of 15 years is Heather Poe. He's 45. They're expecting a child in late spring. A number of conservative groups have expressed dismay at Cheney's pregnancy.
All right. There you go. This is, let's see, what are we doing? This is Scott. You're on the Rick Emerson Show. Hello.
Scott. Yeah, hey, buddy. How's it going?
Hey, what's up?
I was just, you know, a little bit about these dang guys up on the mountain.
Yes.
You know, I just wish they would have a little transponder deal that, they can rent and take up there? Because, man, I'm sure this would cost them mega bucks when they start flying in those C-31s and all that other stuff.
Well, we were talking to the guy from the Bureau of Land Management about this yesterday, and I was trying to shake an answer out of him about whether or not these guys, if they are found alive, whether or not that they're going to have to then pay for the many, many hundreds of thousands of tax dollars that this is costing, which I think is the case. I mean, did you say, Tim, was it you that said this, that it was the guy in the crevasse who ended up having to pay a bunch of money, and that was the thing with the Black Hawk helicopter. Maybe I'm thinking of something else. Yeah. But I know that in California, there was a case a while back where a guy set away. It was some idiot, and he built a campfire and then thought, you know what, I'll go to sleep and leave this campfire blazing right next to me while it's surrounded by dry, tindery wood. And of course, then the forest goes up in flames, and they have to fly in and rescue the guy. And they totally tagged his ass for that. He had to pay, like $250,000. So, I would imagine that there's going to be something like that, especially because this is like the second case of this kind of thing in 2 weeks. So, yeah.
Well, you think as experienced as they are, too, they would have, one of them at least have it. But, you know, I heard on the news somewhere, like Timberline, a lot of people will take Palmer all the way up to the end of Palmer and start hiking from there, and they won't let any hikers go up there without one.
Well, you know, those transponders, which is basically, it's a beacon that is made, they sell these for for marine use, too. If you are a sailor, if you're a boater, if you're going to be out in the middle of the ocean, these things, they're waterproof, they last for like 15 days, they got a sealed battery, you turn on the beacon, and it lets them, you know, zoom right in and find you. They sell those things if you climb the mountains, too, and they're like $150. I mean, it's like unbelievably cheap. Especially if, as we have been told, that these guys were, let's see,
rescuers tell me we have food, fuel.
Oh, I lost you.
Shovel.
Now, I lost you. There you are.
Okay, thank you. And we're done. But yeah, these guys were all laden down with supplies and accessories and so forth. So there you go. No, but they did everything right. Everything. Here's Tim Riley.
This is a bizarre story. A body found in a wooded area of Memphis, Tennessee, is that of an Oregon woman last seen selling magazines to truck drivers at a truck stop in Arkansas. 19-year-old Tracy Jones' last known address was Albany. This week, the body was positively identified as that of her. Memphis police said the body had apparent knife wounds to the head and body.
Oh.
Now, Jones was selling subscriptions for Epic Subscriptions of York, Pennsylvania. Now, the company owner, Robert Blair, who reported her missing, described himself as her employer and her boyfriend.
And she was selling magazine subscriptions at truck stops?
Well, what happened was, apparently they came to her door when she lived in Albany to try to sell her magazines. And she said, Mike, I can't afford these magazines. Well, how would you like to come to work with us? And she said, well, of course I would.
I have no money. I am desperate for employment.
In the meantime, apparently she has an affair with the person who owns this magazine subscription service. And they have a relationship, and he sends her to truck stops to sell magazines, as any concerned boyfriend would.
Why do I suspect that maybe when he was sending her to truck stops, I'm just speculating now, sending her to truck stops and maybe the
Arkansas. Not even Oregon truck, the good kind.
Not even
truck
upscale.
Stops at Arkansas.
Upscale truck stops. That maybe she was, how do I put this? Perhaps she was selling other services or items in addition to the magazines.
Oh, I don't know.
At an Arkansas. Well, look, I will tell you this. No, I'm not trying to paint everybody with this brush. I'm not saying that all. I'm not saying that this happens everywhere because we have, you know, delivery drivers, truck guys who, as they say, drive truck are.
So you're not saying that she was selling Look magazine?
No.
Well,
maybe I'll look at something else. Does Look magazine even exist anymore?
I don't know. I just made that up. I know it was a
great
way
reference.
Back
when. It's a great reference.
That's why I threw it out there.
1962. Mm-hmm. I won't use his name, but I had a friend of mine who was a truck driver, and then his brother was a truck driver, and they would occasionally do just kind of like long haul stuff together. And he described the greatest thing. He said he was at a truck stop, and I forget where. I think it was somewhere in the Midwest because he was based in Utah. But he said that, you know, the thing where the truckers, they'll pull into a truck stop and they have the cab over or whatever. They'll take a nap or they'll just, you know, they got to stop, take a whiz, whatever it is they got to do. So these guys are all at the truck stop. And, you know, if you go into a truck stop that's on a busy highway, busy freeway, at any moment, there's 6, 7, 8, 9 trucks in there that are all just kind of stopped for however long. And so this guy's talking about being at this truck stop somewhere, I think it was in Wyoming. He's sitting there with his brother in the truck. There's 5 or 6 big semis sort of all around in a semicircle, sort of facing the big rest stop, the big bathroom in the middle. And this woman, like, pulls up in a car, in some sort of, you know, what, a Camaro or whatever. This is a Camaro. Woman gets out of the car. She walks over into the parking lot, in front of the bathroom area, facing this semicircle of trucks, and as he put it, begins to do a little bumping and grinding dance in the parking lot in front of the truck. And keep in mind, it's like pitch black. It's 2 a.m. and it's a Wyoming truck stop. And so she's sitting there, and she's kind of doing this like, gyrating hip thrusting dance. She does this for about 35 seconds, and then one of the trucks just like flashes its lights, and there she goes, walks over right under the truck. So I am in no way saying that's
what you like to buy Reader's Digest.
Yes, exactly. I am in no way saying that that is what this woman was doing. I'm just saying that a truck stop in Arkansas seems like a strange place to be selling magazines.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying about it. And so forth.
So much for that.
Here's Tim Riley.
A familiar observation that the Bible is the best-selling book of all time obscures a more startling fact. The Bible is the best-selling book of the year. Every year. Calculating how many Bibles are sold in the U.S. is a virtual impossible task. But a conservative estimate is that in 2005, Americans purchased more than 25 million Bibles.
Is there really a need for 25 million? That's a made-up statistic. There's only 300 million people in the
country. Twice as many as Harry Potter books, and that teaches witchcraft. The amount spent annually on Bibles has been put at $500 million.
And it's 25 million in America, in North America alone. This is like that thing about how Bat Out of Hell and Back in Black sell a million copies every year with no additional advertising.
Right.
How many Bibles?
Of all those Ann Coulter books, how was that possible?
I don't understand how we could... Okay, there's 300 million people in this. How do they even verify? And that brings up a larger question about this claim that they sell 20... This is one of those made-up statistics, like how many homeless people and how many immigrants there are here. 25 million Bibles a year. There are only 300 million people. Why would you need it... Like, why would you need more Bibles than what you've already got? I mean, really, it's not like it's not like a thing that you wear out. Can I just tell you this, though, that my mom had at our house one of those big-ass white Bibles that the Bible salesman used to sell door-to-door.
Oh.
Like in that Maisel's Brothers documentary, Salesman, where they're selling Bibles. And in Paper Moon with Tatum O'Neill?
Yes.
Where the guy's selling Bibles? My mom bought one of those Bibles from some guy in, like, his sample case. Comes door-to-door. Would you like this Bible, which doubles at a... Think of all the wisdom contained within for your family. That also leads me to this thought. You know, a thing that nobody's ever talked about is the financial ramifications of the internet and Wikipedia and Google and so forth on encyclopedia salesmen. Whatever happened to the guys?
They're extinct.
But I mean,
gone the way of the Fuller Rush man.
But within just like a year, in this country, we probably went from having an army of encyclopedia salesmen out there to having them all gone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get back to this Bible business for a second. I mean, we had like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, but none of them read, by the way. And my mother, at a certain point, would consider herself a very religious person. So maybe I think she read hers, but the other Bibles, they just sit there. They're only there, they're just there, I think, for the same reason the encyclopedias were, that you have them in the house. Because encyclopedia salesmen would do this thing where, like, they would somehow swindle these parents into believing that if you just bought the encyclopedias and had them in the house, somehow your kid would become smart. Like, through osmosis, the knowledge would just go into your kid's head. That never happens. Same thing with the Bible. You have it there, somehow your kid will not become an evil homosexual and turn to crack. So the Bible's just there. My final thought on this is, I mean, this sounds like a daft question, but is there a copyright on the Bible? I mean, there can't be.
No. I don't think so.
So could I publish...
Schuster?
Yeah, but I mean, nobody owns... Well, like, think about this. Is there a copyright on Beethoven's Fifth? Does someone own, like, Ode to Joy by Beethoven?
Oh, I don't know.
See, these are the things I wonder about. Like, could I...
mean, there are copyrights on certain things, things go in public domain.
But, I mean, okay, so could I publish...
Your own Bible?
That's what I'm saying. Could I publish the Bible and, like, make it just like the regular Bible in every way, except, like, change one of the commandments to, like, you know, change one of the commandments to, like, that thou shalt, you know, what's a commandment that should be changed? I could change one.
Thou shalt not kill.
Yeah, thou shalt kill repeatedly and with much.
People don't follow it anyway.
With much anger. No, and then just sell it as. Could I just sell that as the Bible? And is there any organization that would stop me?
When I was growing up, there were hippy-dippy Bibles with people with long hair on the cover. One was called The Way. I remember that. They were trying to get...
The 70s Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I have the Rappin' with Jesus Bible, which is it ended up being unintentionally comedic, but it was written as a legit. They wrote it straight up. It was a Bible for young urban read black youth, and it was the Bible. And I swear to God, it was rendered in what these idiot writers believe to be the language that our young black brethren speak these days. And it's called Rappin' with Jesus. And I swear to Christ, no pun intended. I'll bring it in and read from it. Instead of thou shalt not steal, it literally says, like, don't be bogarting nobody's stuff, which is fantastic. Don't be wasting nobody instead of thou shalt not kill. And that is what it says. And they sold it at a Christian bookstore. It was called Rappin' with Jesus. And it was a Bible to communicate with young black youth. There's also the inclusive Bible where they don't say father, they say parent. And they don't say mankind, they say humankind. But I just want to publish a Bible that is just like, but just change some things just to screw with people. Mm-hmm. Like, have the Bible be just like the regular Bibles in every way, except for you have, like, throw a sentence in somewhere that really strongly encourages sodomy on Tuesdays. You know what I mean? And then you could reference it.
Like a San Francisco values.
Exactly, yeah, but and then you could point to it. You know, Ezekiel 5:16, thou shalt engage in sodomy forcefully with a pause for lunch and applesauce.
Signed, Nancy Pelosi.
On Tuesday. And then you just sell it. Oh, wait, here's somebody might know here. Tim, you're on the Rick Emerson Show. Hello.
Rick, as it turns out, the King James Bible is the only version that is not copyrighted. And that's only because they didn't have copyright law back when they translated it.
So, well, when you say the King James Version,
when you look at a Bible, it just says King James Version. That is not copyrighted. But if you bought, like, a New International Version or a Revised Standard Version, those would be copyrighted.
Copyrighted by who, though?
Just the...
It's written by...
Like, Zondervan Publishing, just the company that... Either the group of individuals that publish it or the publishing company itself.
But that doesn't make any sense, because the Bible is a divinely inspired document written by the Lord. I don't understand how they can...
The verses, like, say, okay, like, you stayed up late on the weekends and your days off and translated the Greek New Testament, and you came up with the... Northwest Portland version of the Bible, you could copyright that because that's your translation, your work.
So, just like the Bible that I got sitting in my house, where it just says, the Holy Bible on the front. There's somebody somewhere who owns a copyright on that. So what if I just taken...
Not the King James Version, yes.
Okay, but what if I just taken and altered the words ever so slightly? Can I then claim that is my own translation if I just alter a few things here and there? Like change the word now to not and vice versa?
Well, you would have to be able to demonstrate... you'd have to be able to demonstrate that you legitimately worked on a translation from, like, the original... Greek
language, or whatever you're saying.
You can't just change a couple words. You've actually got to work on translating the entire, there has to have a flow and a context of just kind of the same vibe of the way you're writing it.
What if I just claimed it was divinely inspired by the King of all creation?
Well, that doesn't work anymore. Actually got to have some work in it.
How ironic. All right. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right, there you go.
I'm more confused than when we began.
I have no idea. Now, I'm fascinated by this. I want to have, like, the great thing is, like, I wouldn't even label it as being a different version. You know? You market it for all the world like it was a regular Bible. You just change enough stuff in there just to screw with. Because then you could point to the Bible. You could say, well, look, the Bible says right here.
The original version from God.
Yeah, Leviticus 5:19. It clearly says that grape otter pops are the definitive snack. You know, for summertime fun. All right, we should break here. We'll come back with more. I'm sorry, we've gotten off track. We'll come back. We will resume the Ministry of Truth with Tim Riley. It's 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. Don't go anywhere. The Rick Emerson Show continues next. Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-733-2970. Rick William Hung. Well, I know this. This is the guy from American Idol, right? I think Scotty J is trying to find a clever way to say he is hungover. Ha ha. Never try to be clever when you're hungover. My goddaughter's in that School of Rock thing, and they played at the Doug Fir last night, so I'm in the same boat as Scotty J. Best show ever. It's 503-733-2970. Here is Tim Riley at the Ministry of Truth.
Well, it gives me great pleasure to read this. Vegetarians are more intelligent, says a brand new study. Frequently dismissed as cranks, their fussy eating habits tend to make them unpopular with dinner party hosts and guests alike. But now it seems they may have the last laugh when the research is showing vegetarians are more intelligent than their carnivorous friends. A study of thousands of men and women revealed that those who stick to a vegetarian diet have IQs that are around 5 points higher than those who eat meat.
This is going to be like how I always say.
They're also more sallow and sickly looking.
I beg your pardon.
I'm just kidding.
No, Tim will be reading this same story standing on my grave someday.
No, Tim always looks refreshed, I have to say.
Broadcasting from in front of my tombstone.
I did the best I could without power this morning. The British Medical Journal says researchers say it isn't clear why veggies are brainier, but admit the fruit and veggie-rich vegetarian diet could somehow boost brain power. Why not try it yourself?
Yes. Is this Romeo or Romeo? Ramo.
Romel.
Okay. Hello, sir.
Oh, hi. I just want to let you know that...
Is there an ice cream truck in the background?
Oh, actually, that's my daughter playing with her toys. I just want to let you know the patents in U.S. Only last for 95 years. And the ones in UK last for 65.
All right. Well, somebody told me that, and also that there's a, I know there's a difference in us and Britain where the stuff falls into the public domain after like 50 years. You didn't know the Beatles stuff about to fall into the public domain?
Yeah, that's what I get. Yeah, I read that article on the New York Times regarding that. It's going to be public domain, their first album, actually.
Well, that's it, man. I'm going to get cracking on my own version of the Bible.
There you go.
The King Rick version. All right. Thank you, sir.
I'll be in line to buy that.
Excellent. God bless you. Thank you. All right, there you go. You have a few new commandments we're going to add to that. Here's Tim Riley.
Well, we haven't talked to Dr. Meat from the Cleveland Clinic for a while, have we?
Well, he's back.
From where?
The Cleveland Clinic. Well, this weekend and next, stores and shopping malls will be filled with last-minute shoppers. Perhaps one of them will be you. What can make even the most stressed... Let's start that sentence again. What can make that even more stressful is the angst over trying to find that perfect gift with a fast-approaching deadline. Dr. Meat of the Cleveland Clinic says it's tough to do, but now is the time to cut yourself some slack.
I think in most healthy relations and relationships, most people are very concerned with your time as much as the gifting of a present. And your compassion and availability in the holiday.
He doesn't really sound like a guy who'd be called Dr. Meat. He does. And when did gifting become a word? Gifting is like signage. It's a
He's
word.
He's from Cleveland.
Where he works? Where?
At the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Meat of the Cleveland Clinic says some people associate love and acceptance with extravagant gift giving. But
really
he says,
always...
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, but he said... I know you couldn't wait to get to Dr.
No,
Meat.
I can't... Well, I can't wait to get to Dr. Meat. Drive faster.
But he says that could lead to a mountain
Honey,
of debt.
Honey, get me right home. I can't wait to get to Dr. Meat.
It really isn't always about the dollar attached to a gift. And it really can be true that some of the most dear gifts are things that are simple. Things that are made. It doesn't have to put you in debt for 3 or 4 months to show you love someone.
All right.
That's Dr. Meese of the Cleveland Clinic. Time now for a double snuff watch.
It's your snuff watch for Friday.
No music executive put a bigger stamp on modern music than Atlantic Records co-founder Armet Ettingen. He died in New York after slipping into a coma following a head injury while attending a Rolling Stones concert and 60th birthday party for former President Bill Clinton. This is the first I've heard of this. Starting in 1947, the label he founded with Herb Abramson made a name in rhythm and blues with such acts as Ruth Brown, Ray Charles, Big Joe Turner, among many others. Abramson was a dental student and had worked for National Records, and the two young men had become friends a year earlier. They were able to start the record with a $10,000 loan from Ettingen's family dentist. In the 1960s, Ettingen was a nurturing soul singer, such as Aretha Franklin, Roberta Flack, and Wilson Pickett.
helped usher in the invasion of British rockers such as the Rolling Stones, Cream, and Led Zeppelin, and oversaw an American pop music explosion with acts such as Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Sonny & Cher, and Bette Midler. And the label is now home to such diverse acts as Missy Elliott, James Blunt, Stone Temple Pilots, Jewel, Death Cab for Cutie, and Kid Rock.
No, the influence of Ahmet Ertegun cannot be. He's a guy that you don't really hear about.
Ever.
Yeah,
I didn't even know he fell.
Yeah, he did. He's a guy that kind of stays in the background. He's sort of like a Clive Davis figure, but not as well known, not as public. The only fame he got in any recent years, if you saw the movie Ray with Jamie Foxx, Ahmet Ertegun was played there by Richard Schiff, who plays Toby Ziegler on The West Wing. He played Ahmet Ertegun in the movie. Yeah, he signed and discovered and found and nurtured so many acts in every genre. Yeah, from Ray Charles all the way to Zeppelin to Death Cab for Cutie. The influence of that guy, the shadow he casts over the music industry is huge. Will remain so. And he lived a long time, too. How old was he?
83,
yeah. I mean, a long life, man. Can't ask to accomplish more than that guy did.
Part two. It's the 40th anniversary of the death of Walt Disney. And a new book has come out, written by Nick Gabler. The book is entitled Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Gabler seeks to paint an accurate picture, warts and all, of one of America's cultural icons.
I think the single most important thing is what Disney changed the way
I am creepy
about the world. All of these things are connected by the power of wish fulfillment. And Walt Disney taught us, in a way, whether vicariously or not, that we could impose our will on the world and change it to shape our own reality. Disneyfication, detractors call it, but that may be his most powerful legacy.
While your parents are gone, we're going to play the kissing game.
Oh.
I'm sorry. That was a great little visceral response. Just sort of a grunting grimace of horror.
Yes, Mr. Disney is best known for leaving his mark in American culture.
His mark on the culture is indelible. And the war over Walt Disney still wages and rages. That is that there are people who love Walt Disney and love all the things he's done. And there are people who hate Walt Disney. And there's almost no middle ground. And those factions are still battling with one another 40 years later.
This is going to be our little secret. If you tell anyone, I'll kill a kitten.
We won't have any more puppet shows at my house when your parents are not.
Finger puppet shows. Well, the saddest part of all is that Walt Disney is not frozen, as it is often claimed when he died 40 years ago.
Disney on ice.
He's not floating around in some big soup vat somewhere, but rather he was cremated and buried at Forest Lawn Cemetery.
I think the single most important thing is what Disney changed the way we think about the world. All of these things are connected by the power of wish fulfillment. And Walt Disney taught us, in a way, whether vicariously or not, that we could impose our will on the world and change it to shape our own reality. Disneyfication, detractors call it, but that may be his most powerful legacy.
Today. I've hidden a bright, shiny quarter somewhere in my body. If you can find it, you can have it.
And that is the end of the snuff watch. Someone snuff watching.
Go back to Dr. Meat. He's less creepy. Here's Tim Riley.
It looks like Jessica Simpson has become Christina Carlson in this picture.
Oh, hey, totally. Yeah, and they both kind of become Jamie
Presley.
Remember
this young lady?
Oh, yeah.
Are they the same person?
Well, you know, that's got to be fake hair. Jessica Simpson's hair.
It looks like they're fake eyes and face.
Everyone's hair in Hollywood
is fake.
She's
got a fake head. They're just screwing a big piece of plasticine under her shoulders now. Yeah, everybody in Hollywood has fake hair because from one day to the next, it's never the same length. And I know they don't have that. Maybe they just have that Barbie hair where you just sort of yank it out of the back and there's like a twisty thing and it just feeds out the top like a spool.
While Jessica Simpson is still having a hard time finding a good, cute guy she likes, Nick Lachey is already thinking about walking down the aisle again. Hunky Nick has reportedly called his ex-wife Jessica Simpson to tell her he is getting married again.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, if only I could have been there.
That just hurt.
If only I could only to have been looking in a window while she received the call.
The singer is planning to marry new girlfriend Vanessa Vanilla.
Oh, am I?
Vanessa Vanillo. And wants to break the news to his ex-wife himself.
Of course he does.
He spent 40 minutes on the telephone explaining his intentions.
Uh-huh.
According to the National Ledger website, Nick told Jessica, quote, "I'm getting married again, Jess, and I wanted you to hear it from me," unquote.
The former 98 Degree singer is allegedly hoping to be married by the end of the year, but time is running out, so he better act promptly. Despite being the first to file for divorce, Jessica reacted badly to the news. A source said she knew Nick and Vanessa were serious, but this threw her. She did her best to contain her so-called emotions.
Seriously.
With her so-called face that just seems weirdly plastic and immobile all the time. And how great is that? Because she's the one who dumped him, right? She filed for divorce.
Uh-huh.
And then now she's...
He's the good guy.
What is... Totally. And this is... Yeah, you are witnessing, by the way, the beginning of the long, sad decline of Jessica Simpson. And this is on the heels of that great story we had a couple weeks ago. And by great, I mean great because it's happening to someone else. Where the headline was, Jessica says, I can't quit eating. And something, somebody caught a picture of her, like, at Spago or whatever, you know, like, just, like, stuffing, shoveling pasta by the pound into her head. That's fantastic.
Nicole Richie could be adding strengths to her wardrobe in the near future. And not the kind you're thinking. TMZ has found court documents that reveal that Richie pled no contest 4 years ago to driving under the influences. Now, under California law, if Richie is convicted of DUI as a result of Monday's arrest, a judge must impose a jail sentence. The law requires a mandatory sentence, 5 consecutive days in county jail, as well as 1 year license suspension to anyone convicted twice, as she may be.
Now, is DUI only alcohol, though, or is that other substances?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not familiar with California law.
Yeah, I don't know in California.
Oh, wait a minute. It says here, Richie would be ordered to attend an alcohol education program for a year and a half, even if the second conviction is not alcohol-related.
Because she was convicted, she had marijuana in her system and like Vicodin.
She's been arrested for heroin possession.
Nicole Richie?
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't heard that.
I hadn't heard that either. Heroin?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
She was arrested a while ago for heroin possession.
I didn't know that.
What's
wrong
with her?
Seriously.
That was during her chunky stage. That's when she gained a lot of weight during the first season of The Simple Life. Because she had just gone through rehab.
Oh, I see. So it's the secret ingredient is heroin.
Yeah, so she's been arrested a bunch of times. She got arrested for heroin.
This can't continue.
Yeah, for the DUI and then
really,
now for the...
Yeah, this has to be stopped. Heroin seems like...
That's something out of the 60s.
Yeah, really. I mean, and like, to me, there is everything else, and then there is heroin. Like, heroin is its own, and I guess crack, maybe.
Yeah.
Although, can I just tell you this, and I will not reveal names at all, but the number of people I know smoked crack... It's astonishing, actually. Sometimes the people. Did you ever know somebody like that, where it's like you'll talk to them and they'll drop that really casually, like, "Well, yeah, I mean, I used to smoke crack," and then mm-hmm. and then they move on, like, "But now I'm ready to get lunch. Where would you like to shop today?" And you're like, and you're still back on the like, "I can't believe like you smoked crack." Thing. I mean, whatever. It's not like I'm some moralist. I don't care.
Back in the 80s, record distributors just give it away for number five spot.
That's totally.
Come up to the parking lot. I have something for you.
I need this.
That wasn't me, by the way.
No, it wasn't me either, but it was a music director that I once knew. And it was a whole lot of, "Look, I need these two ads this week. And if you can up the spins to 30, that'd be fantastic. There's a little something."
It doesn't matter if you really play it.
It was exactly a paper ad, as they call it. There used to be, and of course, this doesn't happen anymore. In any way that we're aware of. There used to be, in radio, there was this thing called ads. And the phrase Top 40 Radio came out of an era when there were literally 40 songs that the radio station was really pounding a lot. And you still know that concept today. It's those same songs that you complain about hearing all the time. And God damn it, they play the same songs every day, all day. Those are the Top 40. And I don't know if it's 40 anymore, but it used to be literally the Top 40 songs in the radio station's library, the ones that got played the most. And, of course, there's only 40 slots every week. And there's new songs being released every Tuesday, I think it is. And so every Tuesday you would get the music director of the radio station would get these phone calls from record promoters who were hired by record companies to get the new single on the air. And the thing is, if there's only 40 slots for the popular songs... If you want to get a new song in there, an old song's got to go. And so they would hire these record promoters, and their sole job was to come to the radio station and get you to take a song off the playlist and insert their song in that slot. And it was called getting an ad. It was a, "Hey, can I get you to add the new Nelson song this week?" And, whatever. You know, "Can I get you to add the new Paula Abdul," or whatever it was in the 80s. And that the deal is you would take a song that you were currently playing a lot and you would put it on the shelf. And then the new song, the new Paula Abdul song, would go in that slot and it would get played to death. And they want those ads because that in turn gets the promoter paid by the record company. Because the record company says, good job, record promoter, for getting us added at all of these stations.
And in some cases, the record promoter was the PD who originally hired you, then went to work with the record company. Remember when you were living in your car?
Remember when I hired you? Give me three ads this week.
What market would you like to work in next?
How do you feel about New York or Decatur? And sometimes there would be this thing called a paper ad. And I do think, I get criticized sometimes because people say that we talk too much about radio, but I think people find a lot of this interesting because you never really hear, and the people who say that are other people in radio who don't necessarily
who jump
like
at
all
the
this,
chance to do the same thing.
Really, who don't necessarily like it because they are not allowed to talk
about
it.
They're not being approached.
Yeah, but there was a thing called a paper ad, and a paper ad was when you would claim you were going to be playing a record a lot, and then in turn the promoter could go back to the record company and say, hey, look at them, the station, they're playing that song you sent me out to get played. Look at that, give me my money, and or cocaine. And you weren't really playing the record, you were just claiming you played it, and that was a paper ad. Kind of like when somebody has paper wealth but no real wealth.
And call R&R and give them a quote on this, will you?
Exactly, and it was exactly
like
that.
Sounds great on the radio.
Exactly. Going for ads this week in, it was exactly like that episode of WKRP, though. I had a music director in a market that I will not identify, in a format that I will not identify, where the record promoter from a record company, which I will not identify, would come in, and it would be like, and it would be the big stack of CDs. Hey, here's the singles we're pushing this week.
Just like Christmas. Every Tuesday.
And it was a white Christmas. It was a snow-filled Christmas, where they would say, look, here's single number one we want you to play. Here's single number two. Here's a bag of cocaine. Here's single number three. Here's single number four. And it was like right there. And you would go in and like, I remember going in at one point, and it's, you know, they'd say, so what's going on here at this fine radio station where I'm going to play? Nothing. The record promoter was just here. And the music director suddenly had just developed like the worst case of post-nasal drip ever.
There's a young lady I'd like you to meet at the next record convention.
Seriously.
She'll be on the third floor next to the hospitality suite.
Oh, exactly. Her name is Tiffany. And
she's a local gal.
She'd love to show you a good time when you're in town, by the way. Can you play this new Madonna single? So those times are gone, though. That doesn't happen anymore.
No.
In no way. Sarah just laughed. What are you implying, Sarah?
I'm just saying I might be young in the radio circuit, but yeah.
Yes. Something you'd like to share with the group?
I'm just saying, I don't think all of that, I don't think that's all gone. That's all. Not here. Not at CBS Radio.
No, you mean it is gone at CBS Radio.
It never happened here.
Of course not. We are pure as the driven snow, so to speak.
I'm just saying it's funny.
It is amusing, isn't it?
Here's Tim Riley.
Well, Bob Dylan is attempting to block the release of Edie Sedgwick's biopic in an argument over his role in the pop icon's death. Yeah. Sedgwick, a muse of Andy Warhol, died at the age of 28 from an overdose of barbiturates in 1971.
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Tim Johnson, paging Senator Tim Johnson.
It is believed. Maybe I should become a music director again. It is believed that the film implies that the singer was indirectly responsible for his or her suicide. This is just getting worse, isn't it? Dylan has written to the producers of Factory Girl, demanding that the film not be released until he has determined whether or not he defames him. The picture is due to open in a limited release on December 29th. Sedgwick befriended Dylan in the late 1960s. And the pair is believed to have had an affair. Well, Factory... I have no idea what this is about at this point, but I'll keep reading. While Factory Girl is sought to detail the breakup of their relationship and this negative effect on Sedgwick has become addicted to heroin...
I don't understand what we're talking about.
The film does not actually mention Dylan by name.
And we're done.
I think this is done.
I swear to God, you want to know what just arrived in my inbox? And I will remove the...
Does it come in a bag?
Well, who knows? I'm not going to... I will not use the name of the band. But I swear to God, by absolute coincidence, I will remove the identifying information. This email just arrived as we were having this discussion. Hi, Rick. This is Blank from a Los Angeles-based band called Blank. We're heading north on a West Coast tour of our new single, Blank. I'm in contact with Blank, who threw out your name. We'll be up north in January and February. We have an album and a single, so if any way you could help us out, it would be highly appreciated. We'd do anything you needed in return. Let us know, Blank. I don't think it's anybody we really know. It's apparently a friend of a friend.
Do we know the person that referred them?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. All right, good times. I'm sorry. We should take a...
Okay.
I'll bleep that.
Yeah.
I'll bleep...
Oh. Rickett.
No, as though I were from India.
Yes.
Hello. The Rick Emerson the show. Back after this, Ed McCarthy talks about those guys on Mount Hood for whatever reason. Later on, Jim Roop joins us. Scott Daly reviews Rocky Balboa, ladies and gentlemen, and we find out exactly how drunk Scotty J still is. You stay there.